Side 9. Good Omens. The Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter, Witch. By Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. Continuing on page 293. Adam looked astounded.
Dog's not a mutt. Dog's a remarkable dog. He's clever.
Dog, you get off Mr. Tyler's horrible old poodle. Dog ignored him. He'd got a lot of dog catching up still to do.
Dog,
said Adam ominously. His dog slunk back to his master's bicycle.
I don't believe you have answered my question. Where are you four off to?
To the air base, said Brian.
If that's all right with you,
said Adam, with what he hoped was bitter and scathing sarcasm.
I mean, we wouldn't want to go there if it wasn't all right with you.
You cheeky little monkey, said R.P. Tyler. When I see your father, Adam Young, I will inform him in no uncertain terms that...
But the them were already pedaling off down the road, in the direction of Lower Tadfield Air Base, traveling by the them's route, which was shorter and simpler and more scenic than the route suggested by Mr. Tyler. R.P. Tyler had composed a lengthy metal letter on the failings of the youth of today. It covered falling educational standards, the lack of respect given to their elders and betters, the way they always seem to slouch these days instead of walking with a proper upright bearing, juvenile delinquency, the return of compulsory national service, birching, flogging, and dog licenses. He was very satisfied with it. He had a sneaking suspicion that it would be too good for the Tadfield Advertiser, and had decided to send it to the Times.
Put, 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 put.
Excuse me, love, said a warm female voice. I think we're lost. It was an aging motor scooter, and it was being ridden by a middle-aged woman. Clutching her tightly, his eyes screwed shut, was a rain-coated little man with a bright green crash helmet on. Sticking up between them was what appeared to be an antique gun with a funnel-shaped muzzle.
Oh, where are you going?
Lower Tadfield. I'm not sure of the exact address, but we're looking for someone, said the woman. Then, in a totally different voice, she said,
His name is Adam Young.
R.P. Tyler boggled.
You want that boy? He asked. What's he done now?
No, no, don't tell me. I don't want to know.
Boy, said the woman. You didn't tell me he was a boy. How old is he?
Then she said,
He's 11.
Well, I do wish you'd mentioned this before. It puts a completely different complexion on things.
R.P. Tyler just stared. Then he realized what was going on.
The woman was a ventriloquist.
What he had taken for a man in a green crash helmet, he now saw was a ventriloquist dummy. He wondered how he could ever have assumed it was human. He thought the whole thing was in vaguely bad taste.
I saw Adam Young not 5 minutes ago, he told the woman. He and his little cronies were on their way to the American Air Base.
Oh, dear, said the woman, paling slightly. I've never really liked the Yanks.
They're really a very nice people, you know.
Yes, but you can't trust people who pick up the ball all the time when they play football.
Excuse me, said R.P. Tyler. I think it's very good, very impressive. I'm deputy chairman of the local Rotary Club, and I was wondering, do you do private functions?
Only on Thursdays, said Madam Tracy, disapprovingly. And I charge extra.
And I wonder if you could direct us to...
Mr. Tyler had been here before. He wordlessly extended a finger.
and the little scooter went putt, 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 putt down the narrow country lane. As it did so, the gray dummy in the green helmet turned around and opened one eye.
"Ye great southern pillock!"
it croaked. Harpy Tyler was offended, but also disappointed. He'd hoped it would be more lifelike. R.P. Tyler, only 10 minutes away from the village, paused while Schutze attempted another of its wide range of eliminatory functions. He gazed over the fence. His knowledge of country lore was a little hazy, but he felt fairly sure that if the cows lay down, it meant rain. If they were standing, it would probably be fine. These cows were taking it in turns to execute slow and solemn somersaults, and Tyler wondered what it presaged for the weather. He sniffed. Something was burning. It was an unpleasant smell of scorched metal and rubber and leather.
"Excuse me," said a voice from behind him.
R.P. Tyler turned around. There was a large, once black car on fire in the lane, and a man in sunglasses was leaning out of one window, saying through the smoke,
"I'm sorry. I've managed to get a little lost. Can you direct me to Lower Tadfield Air Base? I know it's around here somewhere."
"Your car is on fire." No, Tyler just couldn't bring himself to say it. I mean, the man had to know that, didn't he? He was sitting in the middle of it. Possibly it was some kind of practical joke. So instead he said,
"I think you must have taken a wrong turn about a mile back. A signpost has blown down."
The stranger smiled.
"That must be it," he said.
The orange flames flickering below him gave him an almost infernal appearance. The wind blew towards Tyler across the car, and he felt his eyebrows frizzle.
"Excuse me, young man, but your car is on fire, and you're sitting in it without burning, and incidentally, it's red hot in places."
"No." Should he ask the man if he wanted him to phone the AA? Instead, he explained the route carefully, trying not to stare.
"That's terrific. Much obliged," said Crowley,
as he began to wind up the window. R.P. Tyler had to say something.
"Excuse me, young man," he said.
"Yes?"
"I mean, it's not the kind of thing you don't notice, your car being on fire." A tongue of flame licked across the charred dashboard.
"Funny weather we're having, isn't it?"
he said lamely.
"Is it?"
said Crowley.
"I honestly hadn't noticed."
And he reversed back down the country lane in his burning car.
"That's probably because your car is on fire," said R.P. Tyler sharply.
He jerked Schutze's lead, dragged the little dog to heel.
To the editor.
"Sir, I would like to draw your attention to a recent tendency I have noticed for today's young people to ignore perfectly sensible safety precautions while driving. This evening, I was asked for directions by a gentleman whose car was... No. Driving a car that... No. It was on fire." His temper getting worse, R.P. Tyler stomped the final stretch back into the village.
"Hoy!" shouted R.P. Tyler. "Young?"
Mr. Young was in his front garden, sitting on his deck chair, smoking his pipe. This had more to do with Deirdre's recent discovery of the menace of passive smoking and banning of smoking in the house than he would care to admit to his neighbors. It did not improve his temper. Neither did being addressed as young by Mr. Tyler.
"Yes, your son, Adam."
Mr. Young sighed.
"What's he done now? Do you know where he is?"
Mr. Young checked his watch.
"Getting ready for bed, I would assume."
Tyler grinned, tightly, triumphantly.
"I doubt it. I saw him and his little fiends and that appalling mongrel
not half an hour ago, cycling towards the airbase.
Mr. Young puffed on his pipe. You know how strict they are up there, said Mr. Tyler, in case Mr. Young hadn't got the message. You know what a one your son is for pressing buttons and things, he added. Mr. Young took his pipe out of his mouth and examined the stem thoughtfully.
Humph,
he said. I see, he said. Right, he said. And he went inside. At exactly that same moment, four motorbikes swished to a halt a few hundred yards from the main gate. The riders switched off their engines and raised their helmet visors. Well, three of them did. I was rather hoping we could crash through the barriers, said War wistfully.
That'd only cause trouble, said Famine.
Good.
Trouble for us, I mean. The power and phone lines must be down, but they're bound to have generators, and they'll certainly have radio.
If someone starts reporting that terrorists have invaded the base, then people will start acting logically, and the whole plan collapses.
Huh?
We go in, we do the job, we go out, we let human nature take its course, said Death.
This isn't how I imagined it, chaps, said War. I haven't been waiting for thousands of years just to fiddle around with bits of wire. It's not what you'd call dramatic.
Albrecht Dürer didn't waste his time doing woodcuts of the four button pressers of the apocalypse. I do know that.
I thought there'd be trumpets, said Pollution.
Look at it like this, said Famine. It's just groundwork. We get to do the riding forth afterwards. The proper riding forth. Wings of the Storm and so on.
You've got to be flexible. Weren't we supposed to meet someone? Said War.
There was no sound but the metallic noises of cooling motorbike engines. Then Pollution said slowly,
You know, I can't say I imagined it'd be somewhere like this, either.
I thought it'd be, well, a big city, or a big country, New York, perhaps, or Moscow, or Armageddon itself. There was another pause. Then War said,
Where is Armageddon, anyway?
Funny you should ask, said Famine. I've always meant to look it up.
There's an Armageddon, Pennsylvania, said Pollution. Or maybe it's Massachusetts, or one of them places. Lots of guys in heavy beards and seriously black hats.
Nah, said Famine. It's somewhere in Israel, I think.
Mount Carmel.
I thought that was where they grow avocados.
And the end of the world.
Is that right?
That's one big avocado.
I think I went there once, said Pollution.
The old city of Megiddo, just before it fell down. Nice place. Interesting royal gateway.
War looked at the greenness around them.
Boy, she said,
did we take a wrong turning? The geography is immaterial.
Sorry, Lord?
If Armageddon is anywhere, it is everywhere.
That's right, said Famine. We're not talking about a few square miles of scrub and goats anymore.
There was another pause.
Let us go.
War coughed.
It's just that I thought that he'd be coming with us.
Death adjusted his gauntlets.
This, he said firmly, is a job for the professionals.
Afterwards, Sergeant Thomas A. Deisenberger recalled events at the gate as having happened like this. A large staff car drew up at the gate. It was sleek and official-looking, although afterwards he wasn't entirely sure why he had thought this, or why it sounded momentarily as though it were powered by motorbike engines. Four generals got out. Again, the sergeant was a little uncertain of why he had thought this. They had proper identification.
What kind of identification, admittedly, he couldn't quite recall, but it was proper. He saluted. And one of them said, "Surprise inspection, soldier." To which Sergeant Thomas A. Deisenberger replied, "Sir, I have not been informated as to the incidents of a surprise inspection at this time, sir." "Of course not," said one of the generals. "That's because it's a surprise." The sergeant saluted again. "Sir, permission to confirmate this intelligence with base command, sir," he said uneasily. The tallest and thinnest of the generals strolled a little way from the group, turned his back, and folded his arms. One of the others put a friendly arm around the sergeant's shoulders and leaned forward in a conspiratorial way. "Now, see here." He squinted at the sergeant's name tag. "Deisenberger, maybe I'll give you a break. It's a surprise inspection, got that? Surprise. That means no getting on the horn the moment we've gone through, understand? And no leaving your post. Career soldier like you'll understand, am I right?" he added. He winked. "Otherwise, you'll find yourself busted so low you'll have to say sir to an imp." Sergeant Thomas A. Deisenberger stared at him. "Private," hissed one of the other generals. According to her tag, her name was Wall. Sergeant Deisenberger had never seen a female general like her before, but she was certainly an improvement. "What? Private, not imp?" "Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah, private. Okay, soldier?" The sergeant considered the very limited number of options at his disposal. "Sir? Surprise inspection, sir?" he said. "Provisionatedly classificitioned at this time," said Famine, who had spent years learning how to sell to the federal government and could feel the language coming back to him. "Sir, affirmative, sir," said the sergeant. "Good man," said Famine as the barrier was raised. "You'll go a long way." He glanced at his watch. "Very shortly." Sometimes human beings are very much like bees. Bees are fiercely protective of their hive, provided you are outside it. Once you're in, the workers sort of assume that it must have been cleared by management and take no notice. Various freeloading insects have evolved a mellifluous existence because of this very fact. Humans act the same way. No one stopped the four as they purposefully made their way into one of the long, low buildings under the forest of radio masts. No one paid any attention to them. Perhaps they saw nothing at all. Perhaps they saw what their minds were instructed to see. Because the human brain is not equipped to see war, famine, pollution, and death when they don't want to be seen, and has got so good at not seeing that it often manages not to see them even when they abound on every side. The alarms were totally brainless, and thought they saw four people where people shouldn't be, and went off like anything. Newt did not smoke, because he did not allow nicotine to gain entry to the temple of his body, or, more accurately, the small Welsh Methodist tin tabernacle of his body. If he had been a smoker, he would have choked on the cigarette that he would have been smoking at this time in order to steady his nerves. Anathema stood up purposefully and smoothed the creases in her skirt. "Don't worry," she said. "They don't apply to us. Something's probably happening inside." She smiled at his pale face. "Come on," she said. "It's not the OK Corral." "No. They've got better guns, for one thing," said Newt. She helped him up. "Never mind," she said. "I'm sure you'll think of a way." It was inevitable that all four of them couldn't contribute equally, Moore thought. She'd been surprised at her natural affinity for modern weapon systems, which were so much more efficient than bits of sharp metal. And, of course, Pollution laughed at absolutely foolproof, fail-safe devices. Even Famine at least knew what computers were. Whereas, well, He didn't do anything much except hang around, although he did it with a certain style. It had occurred to War that there might one day be an end to war, an end to famine, possibly even an end to pollution, and perhaps this was why the fourth and greatest horseman was never exactly what you might call one of the lads. It was like having a tax inspector in your football team. Great to have him on your side, of course, but not the kind of person you wanted to have a drink and a chat with in the bar afterwards. You couldn't be 100% at your ease. A couple of soldiers ran through him as he looked over Pollution's skinny shoulder.
"What are those glittery things?" he said in the tones of one who knows he won't be able to understand the answer, but wants to be seen to be taking an interest.
"Seven-segment LED displays," said the boy. He laid loving hands on a bank of relays, which fused under his touch, and then introduced a swath of self-replicating viruses that whirred away on the electronic ether. "I could really do without those bloody alarms," muttered Famine. Death absent-mindedly snapped his fingers. A dozen klaxons gurgled and died.
"I don't know. I'd rather like them," said Pollution.
War reached inside another metal cabinet. This wasn't the way she'd expected things to be, she had to admit. But when she ran her fingers over and sometimes through the electronics, there was a familiar feel. It was an echo of what you got when you held a sword, and she felt a thrill of anticipation at the thought that this sword enclosed the whole world and a certain amount of the sky above it as well. It loved her. A flaming sword. Mankind had not been very good at learning that swords are dangerous if left lying around, although it had done its limited best to make sure that the chances of one this size being wielded accidentally were high. A cheering thought, that. It was nice to think that mankind made a distinction between blowing their planet to bits by accident and doing it by design. Pollution plunged his hands into another rack of expensive electronics. The guard on the hole in the fence looked puzzled. He was aware of excitement back in the base, and his radio seemed to be picking up nothing but static, and his eyes were being drawn again and again to the card in front of him. He'd seen many identity cards in his time. Military, CIA, FBI, KGB even, and being a young soldier, had yet to grasp that the more insignificant an organization is, the more impressive are its identity cards. This one was hellishly impressive. His lips moved as he read it again, all the way from "The Lord Protector of the Commonwealth of Britain charges and demands," through the bit about commandeering all kindling, rope, and igniferous oils, right down to the signature of the WA's First Lord Adjutant, "Praise him, all ye works of the Lord, and fly fornication Smith." Newt kept his thumb over the bit about 9 pence per witch and tried to look like James Bond. Finally, the guard's probing intellect found a word he thought he recognized.
"What's this here?" he said suspiciously. "About us got to give you faggots."
"Oh, we have to have them," said Newt. "We burn them."
"Say what?"
"We burn them."
The guard's face broadened into a grin.
And they'd told him England was soft.
"Right on," he said.
Something pressed into the small of his back.
"Drop your gun," said Anathema behind him, "or I shall regret what I shall have to do next."
Well, it's true, she thought, as she saw the man stiffen in terror. If he doesn't drop the gun, he'll find out this is a stick, and I shall really regret having to be shot. At the main gate, Sergeant Thomas A. Deisenberger was also having problems. A little man in a dirty mac kept pointing a finger at him and muttering, while a lady who looked slightly like his mother talked to him in urgent tones, and kept interrupting herself in a different voice. "It really is vitally important that we are allowed to speak to whoever's in charge," said Aziraphale. "I really must ask that..."
"He's right, you know. I'd be able to tell if he was lying."
"Yes, thank you. I think we'd really achieve something if you'd kindly allow me to carry on."
"All right."
"Thank you.
I was only trying to put in a good word."
"Yes,
You were asking him to..."
"Yes. All right. Now."
"You see my finger?" shouted Shadwell,
whose sanity was still attached to him, but only on the end of a long and rather frayed string.
"Do you see it? This finger, laddie, could send ye to meet your maker."
Sergeant Deisenberger stared at the black and purple nail a few inches from his face. As an offensive weapon, it rated quite highly, especially if it was ever used in the preparation of food. The telephone gave him nothing but static. He'd been told not to leave his post. His wound from Nam was starting to play up. Note: he'd slipped and fallen in a hotel shower when he took a holiday there in 1983. Now, the mere sight of a bar of yellow soap could send him into near-fatal flashbacks. End note. He wondered how much trouble he could get into for shooting non-American civilians. The four bicycles pulled up a little way from the base. Tire marks in the dust and a patch of oil indicated that other travelers had briefly rested there.
"What are we stopping for?" said Pepper.
"I'm thinking," said Adam. It was hard. The bit of his mind that he knew as himself was still there, but it was trying to stay afloat on a fountain of tumultuous darkness. What he was aware of, though, was that his three companions were 100% human. He'd got them into trouble before, in the way of torn clothes, docked pocket money, and so on. But this one was almost certainly going to involve a lot more than being confined to the house and made to tidy up your room. On the other hand, there wasn't anyone else. "All right," he said. "We need some stuff, I think. We need a sword, a crown, and some scales." They stared at him.
"What, just here?" said Brian. "There's nothing like that here."
"I dunno," said Adam. "When you think about the games and that, you know, we've played..." Just to make Sergeant Deisenberger's day, a car pulled up, and it was floating several inches off the ground, because it had no tires, or paintwork. What it did have was a trail of blue smoke, and when it stopped, it made the pinging noises made by metal cooling down from a very high temperature. It looked as if it had smoked glass windows, although this was just an effect caused by it having ordinary glass windows, but a smoke-filled interior. The driver's door opened, and a cloud of choking fumes got out. Then Crowley followed it. He waved the smoke away from his face, blinked, and then turned the gesture into a friendly wave.
"Hi," he said. "How's it going? Has the world ended yet?"
"He won't let us in, Crowley," said Madam Tracy.
"Aziraphale,
is that you?"
"Nice dress," said Crowley vaguely.
He wasn't feeling very well. For the last 30 miles, he had been imagining that a ton of burning metal, rubber, and leather was a fully functioning automobile, and the Bentley had been resisting him fiercely. The hard part had been to keep the whole thing rolling after the all-weather radials had burned away. Beside him, the remains of the Bentley dropped suddenly onto its distorted wheel rims, as he stopped imagining that it had tires. He patted a metal surface hot enough to fry eggs on.
"You wouldn't get that sort of performance out of one of these modern cars," he said lovingly.
They stared at him. There was a little electronic click. The gate was rising. The housing that contained the electric motor gave a mechanical groan and then gave up in the face of the unstoppable force acting on the barrier.
Hey, said Sergeant Deisenberger, which one of you yo-yos did that?
Zip, 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 zip.
And a small dog, its legs a blur. They stared at the four ferociously peddling figures that ducked under the barrier and disappeared into the camp. The sergeant pulled himself together. Hey, he said, but much more weakly this time. Did any of them kids have some space alien with a face like a friendly turd in a bike basket?
Don't think so, said Crowley.
Then, said Sergeant Deisenberger, they're in real trouble. He raised his gun. Enough of this pussyfooting around.
He kept thinking of soap.
And so, he said, are you.
I warned ye, Shadwell began.
This has gone on too long, said Azrafael. Sort it out, Crowley. There's a dear chap.
Hmm? Said Crowley.
I'm the nice one, said Azrafael. You can't expect me to... Oh, blast it. You try to do the decent thing, and where does it get you?
He snapped his fingers. There was a pop like an old-fashioned flashbulb, and Sergeant Thomas A. Deisenberger disappeared.
Said Azrafael.
See? Said Shadwell,
who hadn't quite got the hang of Madam Tracy's split personality.
Nothing to it. Ye stick by me, ye'll be all right.
Well done, said Crowley. Never thought you had it in you.
No, said Azrafael, nor did I, in fact. I do hope I haven't sent him somewhere dreadful.
You'd better get used to it right now, said Crowley. You just send him. Best not to worry about where they go. He looked fascinated. Aren't you going to introduce me to your new body?
Oh? Yes, yes, of course. Madam Tracy, this is Crowley. Crowley, Madam Tracy.
Charmed, I'm sure. Let's get on in, said Crowley. He looked sadly at the wreckage of the Bentley, and then brightened. A jeep was heading purposefully towards the gate, and it looked as though it was crowded with people who were about to shout questions and fire guns and not worry about which order they did this in. He brightened up. This was more what you might call his area of competence. He took his hands out of his pockets, and he raised them like Bruce Lee, and then he smiled like Lee Van Cleef.
Ah, he said, here comes transport.
They parked their bikes outside one of the low buildings. Wensleydale carefully locked his. He was that kind of boy.
So what will these people look like? Said Pepper.
They could look like all sorts, said Adam doubtfully.
They're grown-ups, are they? Said Pepper.
Yes, said Adam. More grown-up than you've ever seen before, I reckon.
Fighting grown-ups is never any use, said Wensleydale gloomily. You always get into trouble.
You don't have to fight 'em, said Adam. You just do what I told you. The them looked at the things they were carrying. As far as tools to mend the world were concerned, they did not look incredibly efficient.
How'll we find them, then?
Said Brian, doubtfully.
I remember when we came to the open day, it's all rooms and stuff. Lots of rooms and flashing lights.
Adam stared thoughtfully at the buildings. The alarms were still yodeling.
Well, he said, it seems to me...
Hey, what are you kids doing here?
It wasn't a 100% threatening voice, but it was near the end of its tether, and it belonged to an officer who'd spent 10 minutes trying to make sense of a senseless world where alarms went off and doors didn't open. Two equally harassed soldiers stood behind him, slightly at a loss as to how to deal with four short and clearly Caucasian juveniles, one of them marginally female.
Don't you worry about us, said Adam airily. We're just looking around.
Now you just, the lieutenant began.
go to sleep, said Adam. You just go to sleep. All you soldiers here go to sleep. Then you won't get hurt. You all just go to sleep. Now.
The lieutenant stared at him, his eyes trying to focus. Then he pitched forward.
Whoo, said Pepper, as the others collapsed. How did you do that?
Well, said Adam cautiously, you know that bit about hypnotism and the boy's own book of 101 things to do that we could never make work?
Yes.
Well, it's sort of like that, only now I've found how to do it.
He turned back to the communications building. He pulled himself together, his body unfolding from its habitual comfortable slouch into an upright bearing Mr. Tyler would have been proud of.
Right,
he said. He thought for a while. Then he said,
come and see.
If you took the world away and just left the electricity, it would look like the most exquisite filigree ever made. A ball of twinkling silver lines, with the occasional coruscating spike of a satellite beam. Even the dark areas would glow with radar and commercial radio waves. It could be the nervous system of a great beast. Here and there, cities make knots in the web, but most of the electricity is, as it were, mere musculature, concerned only with crude work. But for 50 years or so, people had been giving electricity brains, and now it was alive, in the same way that fire is alive. Switches were welding shut, relays fused. In the heart of silicon chips whose microscopic architecture looked like a street plan of Los Angeles, fresh pathways opened up, and hundreds of miles away, bells rang in underground rooms. And men stared in horror at what certain screens were telling them. Heavy steel doors shut firmly in secret hollow mountains, leaving people on the other side to pound on them and wrestle with fuse boxes which had melted. Bits of desert and tundra slid aside, letting fresh air into air-conditioned tombs, and blunt shapes ground ponderously into position. And while it flowed where it should not, it ebbed from its normal beds. In cities, the traffic lights went, then the street lights, then all the lights. Cooling fans slowed, flickered, and stopped. Heaters faded into darkness. Lifts stuck. Radio stations choked off, their soothing music silenced. It has been said that civilization is 24 hours and 2 meals away from barbarism. Night was spreading slowly around the spinning earth. It should have been full of pinpricks of light. It was not. There were 5 billion people down there. What was going to happen soon would make barbarism look like a picnic, hot, nasty, and eventually given over to the ants. Death straightened up. He appeared to be listening intently. It was anyone's guess what he listened with.
He is here, he said.
The other three looked up. There was a barely perceptible change in the way they stood there. A moment before Death had spoken, they, the part of them that did not walk and talk like human beings, had been wrapped around the world. Now they were back. More or less. There was a strangeness about them. It was as if, instead of ill-fitting suits, they now had ill-fitting bodies. Famine looked as though he had been tuned slightly off-station, so that the hitherto dominant signal of a pleasant, thrusting, successful businessman was beginning to be drowned out by the ancient, horrible static of his basic personality. War's skin glistened with sweat. Pollution's skin just glistened.
It's all taken care of, said War, speaking with some effort. It'll take its course.
It's not just the nuclear, Pollution said. It's the chemical. Thousands of gallons of stuff in little tanks all over the world. Beautiful liquids, with 18 syllables in their names. And the old standbys. Save what you like. Plutonium may give you grief for thousands of years, but arsenic is forever. And then winter, said Famine. I like winter. There's something clean about winter. Chickens coming home to roost, said War. No more chickens, said Famine flatly. Only death hadn't changed. Some things don't. The four left the building. It was noticeable that Pollution, while still walking, nevertheless gave the impression of oozing. And this was noticed by Anathema and Newton Pulsifer. It had been the first building they'd come to. It had seemed much safer inside than out, but there seemed to be a lot of excitement. Anathema had pushed open a door covered in signs that suggested that this would be a terminally dangerous thing to do. It had swung open at her touch. When they'd gone inside, it had shut and locked itself. There hadn't been a lot of time to discuss this after the four had walked in. What were they? Said Newt. Some kind of terrorists? In a very nice and accurate sense, said Anathema. I think you're right. What was all that weird talk about? I think possibly the end of the world, said Anathema. Did you see their auras? I don't think so, said Newt. Not nice at all. Oh, negative auras, in fact. Oh? Like black holes. That's bad, is it? Yes. Anathema glared at the rows of metal cabinets. For once, just now, because it wasn't just for play but was for real, the machinery that was going to bring about the end of the world, or at least that part of it that occupied the layers between about 2 meters down and all the way to the ozone layer, wasn't operating according to the usual script. There were no big red canisters with flashing lights. There were no coiled wires with a cut-me look about them. No suspiciously large numeric displays were counting down toward a zero that could be averted with seconds to spare. Instead, the metal cabinets looked solid and heavy and very resistant to last-minute heroism. What takes its course? Said Anathema. They've done something, haven't they? Perhaps there's an off switch, said Newt helplessly. I'm sure if we looked around. These sort of things are wired in. Don't be silly. I thought you knew about this sort of thing. Newt nodded desperately. This was a long way from the pages of Easy Electronics. For the look of the thing, he peered into the back of one of the cabinets. Worldwide communications, he said indistinctly. You could do practically anything. Modulate the mains power, tap into satellites, absolutely anything. You could zip, arg, you could zap, ouch, make things do zipped, ah, just about zap, ooh! How are you getting on in there? Newt sucked his fingers. So far, he hadn't found anything that resembled a transistor. He wrapped his hand in his handkerchief and pulled a couple of boards out of their sockets. Once, one of the electronics magazines to which he subscribed had published a joke circuit, which was guaranteed not to work. At last, they'd said in an amusing way, here's something all you ham-fisted hams out there can build in the certain knowledge that if it does nothing, it's working. It had diodes the wrong way round, transistors upside down, and a flat battery. Newt had built it, and it picked up Radio Moscow. He'd written them a letter of complaint,
but they never replied.
"I really don't know if I'm doing any good," he said. "James Bond just unscrews things," said Anathema.
"Not just unscrews," said Newt, his temper fraying, "and I'm not, zhup, James Bond. If I was, Whizzle, the bad guys would have shown me all the Megadeth levers and told me how they bloody well worked, wouldn't they? Whizzipt! Only it doesn't happen like that in real life. I don't know what's happening, and I can't stop it."
Clouds churned around the horizon. Overhead, the sky was still clear, the air torn by nothing more than a light breeze. But it wasn't normal air. It had a crystallized look to it, so that you might feel that if you turned your head, you might see new facets. It sparkled. If you had to find a word to describe it, the word thronged might slip insidiously into your mind. Thronged with insubstantial beings, awaiting only the right moment to become very substantial. Adam glanced up. In one sense, there was just clear air overhead. In another, stretching off to infinity, were the hosts of heaven and hell, wingtip to wingtip. If you looked really closely and had been specially trained, you could tell the difference. Silence held the bubble of the world in its grip. The door of the building swung open, and the four stepped out. There was no more than a hint of human about three of them now. They seemed to be humanoid shapes made up of all the things they were or represented. They made death seem positively homely. His leather greatcoat and dark visored helmet had become a cowled robe. But these were mere details. A skeleton, even a walking one, is at least human. Death of a sort lurks inside every living creature.
"The thing is," said Adam urgently, "they're not really real. They're just like nightmares, really."
But we're not asleep," said Pepper.
Dog whined and tried to hide behind Adam.
"That one looks as if he's melting," said Brian,
pointing at the advancing figure, if such it could still be called, of Pollution.
"There you are, then," said Adam encouragingly. "It can't be real, can it? It's common sense. Something like that can't be really real."
The four halted a few meters away.
"It has been done," said Death. He leaned forward a little and stared eyelessly at Adam. It was hard to tell if he was surprised.
"Yes, well," said Adam, "the thing is, I don't want it done. I never asked for it to be done."
Death looked at the other three and then back to Adam. Behind them, a jeep skewed to a halt. They ignored it.
"I do not understand," he said. "Surely your very existence requires the ending of the world. It is written."
"I don't see why anyone has to go and write things like that," said Adam calmly. "The world is full of all sorts of brilliant stuff, and I haven't found out all about it yet. So I don't want anyone messing it about or ending it before I've had a chance to find out about it. So, you can all just go away."
"That's the one, Mr. Shadwell," said Azrafael, his words trailing into uncertainty even as he uttered them. "The one with the T-shirt."
Death stared at Adam.
"You are part of us," said War, between teeth like beautiful bullets.
"It is done. We make the world anew," said Pollution, his voice as insidious as something leaking out of a corroded drum into a water table.
"You lead us," said Famine. and Adam hesitated. Voices inside him still cried out that this was true, and that the world was his as well. All he had to do was turn and lead them out across a bewildered planet. They were his kind of people. In tiers above, the host of the sky waited for the word.
"Ye canna want me to shoot him. He's but a bairn."
Said Azrafael. Yes. Perhaps we'd just better wait a bit. What do you think?
"Until he grows up, do you mean?" said Crowley.
Dog began to growl. Adam looked at the them. They were his kind of people, too. You just had to decide who your friends really were. He turned back to the four. "Get them," said Adam quietly. The slouch and slur was gone from his voice. It had strange harmonics. No one human could disobey a voice like that. War laughed and looked expectantly at the them. "Little boys," she said, "playing with your toys. Think of all the toys I can offer you. Think of all the games. I can make you fall in love with me, little boys. Little boys with your little guns." She laughed again. But the machine gun stutter died away as Pepper stepped forward and raised a trembling arm. It wasn't much of a sword, but it was about the best you could do with two bits of wood and a piece of string. War stared at it. "I see," she said. "Mano a mano, eh?" She drew her own blade and brought it up so that it made a noise like a finger being dragged around a wine glass. There was a flash as they connected. Death stared into Adam's eyes. There was a pathetic jingling noise. "Don't touch it," snapped Adam without moving his head. The them stared at the sword rocking to a standstill on the concrete path. "Little boys," muttered Pepper disgustedly. "Sooner or later, everyone has to decide which gang they belong to."
But, said Brian, "she sort of got sucked up the sword."
The air between Adam and Death began to vibrate, as in a heat wave. Wensley Dale raised his head and looked famine in the sunken eye. He held up something that, with a bit of imagination, could be considered to be a pair of scales made of more string and twigs. Then he whirled it around his head. Famine stuck out a protective arm. There was another flash, and then the jingle of a pair of silver scales bouncing on the ground.
"Don't touch them," said Adam.
Pollution had already started to run, or at least to flow quickly, but Brian snatched the circle of grass stalks from his own head and flung it. It shouldn't have handled like one, but a force took it out of his hands, and it whirred like a discus. This time, the explosion was a red flame inside a billow of black smoke, and it smelled of oil. With a rolling, tinny little sound, a blackened silver crown bowled out of the smoke, and then spun round with a noise like a settling penny. At least they needed no warning about touching it. It glistened in a way that metal should not.
"Where'd they go?" said Wensley.
"Where they belong," said Death, still holding Adam's gaze. "Where they have always been, back in the minds of man." He grinned at Adam.
There was a tearing sound. Death's robe split, and his wings unfolded. Angel's wings, but not of feathers. They were wings of night, wings that were shapes cut through the matter of creation into the darkness underneath, in which a few distant lights glimmered. Lights that may have been stars, or may have been something entirely else.
"But I," he said, am not like them. I am Azrael, created to be creation's shadow. You cannot destroy me. That would destroy the world.
The heat of their stare faded. Adam scratched his nose.
Oh, I don't know, he said. There might be a way.
He grinned back.
Anyway, it's going to stop now, he said. All this stuff with the machines, you've got to do what I say just for now, and I say it's got to stop.
Death shrugged.
It is stopping already, he said. Without them, he indicated the pathetic remnants of the other three horsepersons, it cannot proceed. Normal entropy triumphs.
Death raised a bony hand in what might have been a salute.
They'll be back, he said. They're never far away.
The wings flapped, just once, like a thunderclap, and the angel of death vanished.
Right, then, said Adam to the empty air.
All right. It's not going to happen. All the stuff they started, it must stop now. Newt stared desperately at the equipment racks.
You'd think there'd be a manual or something, he said.
We could see if Agnes has anything to say, volunteered Anathema.
Oh, yes, said Newt bitterly. That makes sense, does it? Sabotaging 20th-century electronics with the aid of a 17th-century workshop manual? What did Agnes Nutter know of the transistor?
Well, my grandfather interpreted prediction 3,328 rather neatly in 1948 and made some very shrewd investments, said Anathema. She didn't know what it was going to be called, of course, and she wasn't very sound about electricity in general, but
I was speaking rhetorically.
You don't have to make it work anyway. You have to stop it working. You don't need knowledge for that. You need ignorance.
Newt groaned. All right, he said wearily. Let's try it. Give me a prediction. Anathema pulled out a card at random.
He is not that which he says he is, she read. It's number 1002. Very simple. Any ideas?
Well, look, said Newt wretchedly. This isn't really the time to say it, but...
He swallowed.
Actually, I am not very good with electronics. Not very good at all.
You said you were a computer engineer, I seem to remember.
That was an exaggeration. I mean, just about as much of an exaggeration as you can possibly get. In fact, really, I suppose it was more what you might call an overstatement. I might go so far as to say that what it really was,
Newt closed his eyes,
was a prevarication.
A lie, you mean?
Said Anathema sweetly.
Oh, I wouldn't go that far, said Newt. Although, he added, I'm not actually a computer engineer at all. Quite the opposite.
What's the opposite?
If you must know, every time I try and make anything electronic work, it stops.
Anathema gave him a bright little smile and posed theatrically, like that moment in every conjurer's stage act when the lady in the sequins steps back to reveal the trick.
Tra-la, she said. Repair it, she said.
What?
Make it work better, she said.
I don't know, said Newt. I'm not sure I can.
He laid a hand on top of the nearest cabinet. There was the noise of something he hadn't realized he'd been hearing suddenly stopping, and the descending whine of a distant generator. The lights on the panels flickered, and most of them went out. All over the world, people who had been wrestling with switches found that they switched.
circuit breakers opened. Computers stopped planning World War III and went back to idly scanning the stratosphere. In bunkers under Novaya Zemlya, men found that the fuses they were frantically trying to pull out came away in their hands at last. In bunkers under Wyoming and Nebraska, men in fatigue stopped screaming and waving guns at one another, and would have had a beer if alcohol had been allowed in missile bases. It wasn't, but they had one anyway. The lights came on. Civilization stopped its slide into chaos and started writing letters to the newspapers about how people got overexcited about the least little thing these days. In Tadfield, the machines ceased radiating menace. Something that had been in them was gone, quite apart from the electricity. "Gosh," said Newt. "There you are," said Anathema. "You fixed it good. You can trust old Agnes. Take it from me. Now, let's get out of here." "He didn't want to do it," said Azrafael. "Haven't I always told you, Crowley, if you take the trouble to look deep down inside anyone, you'll find that at bottom they're really quite..." "It's not over," said Crowley flatly. Adam turned and appeared to notice them for the first time. Crowley was not used to people identifying him so readily, but Adam stared at him as though Crowley's entire life history was pasted inside the back of his skull, and he, Adam, was reading it. For an instant, he knew real terror. He'd always thought the sort he'd felt before was the genuine article, but that was mere abject fear beside this new sensation. Those below could make you cease to exist by, well, hurting you in unbearable amounts. But this boy could not only make you cease to exist merely by thinking about it, but probably could arrange matters so that you never had existed at all. Adam's gaze swept to Azrafael.
"Excuse me, why are you two people?" said Adam.
"Well," said Azrafael, "it's a long..." "It's not right being two people," said Adam. "I reckon you'd better go back to being two separate people." There were no showy special effects. There was just Azrafael sitting next to Madam Tracy. "Ooh, that felt tingly," she said. She looked Azrafael up and down. "Oh," she said in a slightly disappointed voice, "somehow I thought you'd be younger." Shadwell glowered jealously at the angel and thumbed the thunder gun's hammer in a pointed sort of way. Azrafael looked down at his new body, which was, unfortunately, very much like his old body, although the overcoat was cleaner. "Well, that's over," he said. "No," said Crowley. "No, it isn't, you see. Not at all." Now there were clouds overhead, curling like a pot of tagliatelle on full boil. "You see," said Crowley, his voice leaden with fatalistic gloom, "it doesn't really work that simply. You think wars get started because some old duke gets shot, or someone cuts off someone's ear, or someone sighted their missiles in the wrong place. It's not like that. That's just, well, just reasons, which haven't got anything to do with it. What really causes wars is two sides that can't stand the sight of one another, and the pressure builds up and up, and then anything will cause it. Anything at all. What's your name, boy? "That's Adam Young," said Anathema, as she strode up with Newt trailing after her. "That's right, Adam Young," said Adam. "Good effort. You've saved the world. Have a half holiday," said Crowley. "But it won't really make any difference."
"I
think you're right, said Azrafael. I'm sure my people want Armageddon. It's very sad.
Would anyone mind telling us what's going on? Said Anathema, sternly, folding her arms.
Azrafael shrugged.
It's a very long story, he began.
Anathema stuck out her chin.
Go on, then, she said. Well, in the beginning...
The lightning flashed, struck the ground a few meters from Adam, and stayed there, a sizzling column that broadened at the base, as though the wild electricity was filling an invisible mold. The humans pressed back against the jeep. The lightning vanished, and a young man made out of golden fire stood there.
Oh, dear, said Azrafael. It's him.
Him who? Said Crowley.
The voice of God, said the angel. The Metatron.
The them stared.
Then Pepper said, No, it isn't. The Metatron's made of plastic, and it's got laser cannon, and it can turn into a helicopter. That's the cosmic Megatron, said Wensleydale weakly. I had one, but the head fell off. I think this one is different.
The beautiful blank gaze fell on Adam Young, and then turned sharply to look at the concrete beside it, which was boiling. A figure rose from the churning ground in the manner of the demon king in a pantomime. But if this one was ever in a pantomime, it was one where no one walked out alive, and they had to get a priest to burn the place down afterwards. It was not greatly different to the other figure, except that its flames were blood red.
Said Crowley, trying to shrink into his seat. Hi.
The red thing gave him the briefest of glances, as though marking him for future consumption, and then stared at Adam. When it spoke, its voice was like a million flies taking off in a hurry. It buzzed a word that felt, to those humans who heard it, like a file dragged down the spine. It was talking to Adam, who said,
Huh?
No, I said already. My name's Adam Young. He looked the figure up and down.
What's yours?
Beelzebub, Crowley supplied. He's the lord of... Thank you, Crowsley, said Beelzebub. Later we must have a serious talk. I am sure thou hast much... to tell me.
Said Crowley, well, you see, what happened was...
Silence!
Right, said Crowley hurriedly.
Now then, Adam Young, said the Metatron, while we can, of course, appreciate your assistance at this point, we must add that Armageddon should take place now. There may be some temporary inconvenience, but that should hardly stand in the way of the ultimate good.
Ah, whispered Crowley to Azrafael. What he means is, we have to destroy the world in order to save it. As to what it stands in the way of, that has yet to be decided, buzzed Beelzebub. But it must be decided now, boy. That is thy destiny. It is written.
Adam took a deep breath. The human watchers held theirs. Crowley and Azrafael had forgotten to breathe some time ago.
I just don't see why everyone and everything has to be burned up and everything, Adam said. Millions of fish and whales and trees and sheep and stuff. And not even for anything important. Just to see who's got the best gang. It's like us and the Johnsonites. But even if you win, you can't really beat the other side, because you don't really want to. I mean, not for good. You'll just start all over again.
you'll just keep on sending people like these two. He pointed to Crowley and Aziraphale. To mess people around. It's hard enough being people as it is, without other people coming and messing you around.
Crowley turned to Aziraphale.
Johnsonites?
He whispered. The angel shrugged.
Early breakaway sect, I think, he said. Sort of Gnostics, like the Ophites.
His forehead wrinkled.
Or were they the Sethites? No, I'm thinking of the Caliridians. Oh, dear, I'm sorry. There were hundreds of them. It's so hard to keep track.
People being messed around, murmured Crowley.
It doesn't matter, snapped the Metatron. The whole point of the creation of the earth and good and evil... I don't see what's so terrific about creating people as people and then getting upset because they act like people, said Adam severely. Anyway, if you stop telling people it's all sorted out after they're dead, they might try sorting it all out while they're alive. If I was in charge, I'd try making people live a lot longer, like old Methuselah. It'd be a lot more interesting, and they might start thinking about the sort of things they're doing to all the environment and ecology, because they'll still be around in 100 years' time.
Ah, said Beelzebub. He actually began to smile. You wish to rule the world. That's more like thy father.
I thought about all that, and I don't want to, said Adam,
half turning and nodding encouragingly at the them.
I mean, there's some stuff could do with Altran, but then I expect people keep coming up to me and getting me to sort out everything the whole time and get rid of all the rubbish and make more trees for them. And where's the good in all that? It's like having to tidy up people's bedrooms for them.
You never tidy up even your bedroom, said Pepper behind him.
I never said anything about my bedroom, said Adam, referring to a room whose carpet had been lost to view for several years. It's general bedrooms, I mean. I didn't mean my personal bedroom. It's an analogy. That's just what I'm saying.
Beelzebub and the Metatron looked at one another.
Anyway, said Adam, it's bad enough having to think of things for Pepper and Wensley and Brian to do all the time so they don't get bored. So I don't want any more world than I've got. Thank you all the same.
Metatron's face began to take on the look familiar to all those subjected to Adam's idiosyncratic line of reasoning.
You can't refuse to be who you are, it said eventually. Listen, your birth and destiny are part of the great plan. Things have to happen like this. All the choices have been made.
Rebellion is a fine thing, said Beelzebub, but some things are beyond rebellion. You must understand.
I'm not rebelling against anything, said Adam in a reasonable tone of voice. I'm pointing out things.
Seems to me you can't blame people for pointing out things.
Seems to me it'd be a lot better not to start fighting and just see what people do. If you stop messing them about, they might start thinking properly and they might stop messing the world around. I'm not saying they would, he added conscientiously, but they might.
This makes no sense, said the Metatron. You can't run counter to the great plan. You must think. It's in your genes. Think.
Adam hesitated.
The dark undercurrent was always ready to flow back, its reedy whisper saying, yes, that was it.
That was what it was all about. You have to follow the plan because you were part of it. It had been a long day. He was tired. Saving the world took it out of an 11-year-old body. Crowley stuck his head in his hands. "For a moment there, just for a moment, I thought we had a chance," he said. "He had them worried. Oh, well, it was nice while..." He was aware that Aziraphale had stood up.
"Excuse me," said the angel.
The trio looked at him.
"This great plan," he said, "this would be the ineffable plan, would it?"
There was a moment's silence.
"It's the great plan," said the Metatron flatly. "You are well aware. There shall be a world lasting 6,000 years, and it will conclude with..."
"Yes, yes, that's the great plan, all right," said Aziraphale. He spoke politely and respectfully, but with the air of one who has just asked an unwelcome question at a political meeting and won't go away until he gets an answer.
"I was just asking if it's ineffable as well. I just want to be clear on this point."
"It doesn't matter," snapped the Metatron. "It's the same thing, surely."
"Surely," thought Crowley. "They don't actually know." He started to grin like an idiot.
"So you're not 100% clear on this?" said Aziraphale.
"It's not given to us to understand the ineffable plan," said the Metatron. "But, of course, the great plan..."
"But the great plan can only be a tiny part of the overall ineffability," said Crowley.
"You can't be certain that what's happening right now isn't exactly right, from an ineffable point of view."
"It is written," bellowed Beelzebub.
"But it might be written differently somewhere else," said Crowley, "where you can't read it."
"In bigger letters," said Aziraphale.
"Underlined," Crowley added.
"Twice,"
suggested Aziraphale.
"Perhaps this isn't just a test of the world," said Crowley. "It might be a test of you people, too."
"God does not play games with his loyal servants," said the Metatron, but in a worried tone of voice.
"Hoo-wee," said Crowley. "Where have you been?"
Everyone found their eyes turning toward Adam. He seemed to be thinking very carefully. Then he said,
"I don't see why it matters what is written, not when it's about people. It can always be crossed out."
A breeze swept across the airfield. Overhead, the assembled host rippled like a mirage. There was the kind of silence there might have been on the day before creation. Adam stood smiling at the two of them, a small figure, perfectly poised exactly between heaven and hell. Crowley grabbed Aziraphale's arm.
"You know what happened?" he hissed excitedly. "He was left alone. He grew up human. He's not evil incarnate or good incarnate. He's just a human incarnate."
Then,
"I think," said the Metatron, "that I shall need to seek further instructions."
"I also," said Beelzebub. His raging face turned to Crowley. "And I shall report of your part in this. Thou hast better believe it."
He glared at Adam.
"And I do not know what thy father will say."
There was a thundering explosion. Chadwell, who had been fidgeting with horrified excitement for some minutes, had finally got enough control of his trembling fingers to pull the trigger. The pellets passed through the space where Beelzebub had been.
Shadwell never knew how lucky he had been that he missed. The sky wavered, and then became just sky. Around the horizon, the clouds began to unravel. Madam Tracy broke the silence. "Weren't they odd?" she said. She didn't mean, "weren't they odd?" What she did mean, she probably could never hope to express, except by screaming. But the human brain has amazing recuperative powers, and saying, "weren't they odd?" was part of the rapid healing process. Within half an hour, she'd be thinking she'd just had too much to drink.
"Is it over, do you think?" said Azrafael.
Crowley shrugged. "Not for us, I'm afraid."
"I don't think you need to go worrying," said Adam gnomically. "I know all about you two. Don't you worry."
He looked at the rest of the them, who tried not to back away. He seemed to think for a while, and then he said,
"There's been too much messing around anyway. But it seems to me everyone's going to be a lot happier if they forget about this. Not actually forget, just not remember exactly. And then we can go home."
"But you can't just leave it at that," said Anathema, pushing forward. "Think of all the things you could do. Good things."
"Like what?" said Adam suspiciously.
"Well, you could bring all the whales back to start with."
He put his head on one side.
"And that'd stop people killing them, would it?"
She hesitated. It would have been nice to say yes.
"And if people do start killing them, what would you ask me to do about them?" said Adam. "No, I reckon I'm getting the hang of this now. Once I start messing around like that, there'd be no stopping it. Seems to me the only sensible thing is for people to know if they kill a whale, they've got a dead whale."
"That shows a very responsible attitude," said Newt. Adam raised an eyebrow.
"It's just sense," he said.
Azrafael patted Crowley on the back.
"We seem to have survived," he said. "Just imagine how terrible it might have been if we'd been at all competent."
Said Crowley.
"Is your car operational?"
"I think it might need a bit of work," Crowley admitted.
"I was thinking that we might take these good people into town," said Azrafael. "I owe Madam Tracy a meal, I'm sure. And her young man, of course."
Shadwell looked over his shoulder, and then up at Madam Tracy.
"Who's he talking about?"
he asked her triumphant expression. Adam rejoined them.
"I reckon we'll just be getting home," he said.
"But what actually happened?" said Pepper.
"I mean, there was all this..." "It doesn't matter anymore," said Adam.
"But you could help so much,"
Anathema began as they wandered back to their bikes. Newt took her gently by the arm.
"That's not a good idea," he said.
"Tomorrow is the first day of the rest of our lives."
"Do you know," she said, "of all the trite sayings I've ever really hated, that comes top?"
"Amazing, isn't it?" said Newt happily.
"Why have you got Dick Turpin painted on the door of your car?"
"It's a joke, really," said Newt.
"Hmm?"
"Because everywhere I go, I hold up traffic," he mumbled wretchedly. Crowley looked glumly at the controls of the Jeep.
"I'm sorry about the car," Azrafael was saying. "I know how much you liked it. Perhaps if you concentrated really hard..."
It wouldn't be the same, said Crowley.
I suppose not.
I had it from New, you know. It wasn't a car. It was more a sort of whole-body glove. He sniffed. What's burning? He said. A breeze swept up the dust and dropped it again. The air became hot and heavy, imprisoning those within it like flies in syrup. He turned his head and looked into Azrafael's horrified expression.
But it's over, he said. It can't happen now. The thing, the correct moment or whatever, it's gone past. It's over.
The ground began to shake. The noise was like a subway train, but not one passing under. It was more like the sound of one coming up. Crowley fumbled madly with a gear shift.
That's not Beelzebub, he shouted, above the noise of the wind. That's him, his father. This isn't Armageddon. This is personal. Start, you bloody thing.
The ground moved under Anathema and Newt, flinging them onto the dancing concrete. Yellow smoke gushed from between the cracks.
It feels like a volcano, shouted Newt. What is it?
Whatever it is, it's pretty angry, said Anathema. In the jeep, Crowley was cursing. Azrafael laid a hand on his shoulder.
There are humans here, he said.
Yes, said Crowley, and me.
I mean, we shouldn't let this happen to them.
Well, what? Crowley began, and stopped.